For our audience of blind and print-impaired folks, your North Carolina Reading Service presents... The Indie Week, and it's read today by John Federson. Our edition is dated on August the 4th of 2021 today. And a byline to our music theme presentation today is this very interesting instrument. It's called a jaw harp, and also been known as a Jew's harp. And this is its sound, provided by Mr. Ronald B. in our studio today. And, of course, that's a bamboo or metal tongue attached to a frame which is held between the jaws of the player. And Mr. Ronald B., who didn't want his last name fully spelled out, and the short there was a short sample. Now, a question from you all, what does that have to do with the performance of our theme music today? Well, the answer is nothing. And so Ronald B. will not be here at the end of the broadcast with our closing theme. And thank you, Ronald. The parking lot is on your left as you exit the building. Thank you. Well, our issue of Indie Week is quite thick this today, so I better get at it. Thomas E. McDonald's opens from Durham. Union bashing. Duke University administrators this year hired a law firm with an anti-union reputation shortly after its academic publisher announced that it had created a workers' union to collectively bargain for competitive salaries, paid leave, fairness, and transparency. Employees of Duke University Press, DUP, in late March announced on Twitter their intention to form the Duke University Press Workers' Union. Founded in 1921, DUP has long been recognized as a national leader amongst academic presses, with the publishing of books and journals that recognize the more marginalized sectors of society, with topics ranging from LGBTQ issues to critical ethnic studies. One day after DUP employees made their announcement, Duke University hired Ogletree, Deakins, Nash, Smoke, and Stewart, a multinational law firm with a reputation for cracking unions apart. Sandra Korn has worked as an assistant editor with DUP for a little over 6 years. She has a master's degree and earns about $43,000 a year, an unconscionable salary from a private university that's ranked as one of the best in the world with an $8.5 billion endowment, she said. She told Indy, it's the wealthiest private university in North Carolina, but there are people who have been with the press for decades who make less than what I do. If there's a precedent for employers to raise wages in Durham, Duke University should be that employer. Duke University officials were not immediately available for comment. In June, about 96% of the DUP's roughly 70 non-supervisory employees cast ballots for or against the union. It's close right now, says Lee Willoughby-Harris, a DUP marketing manager, says about the results. The actual result will depend on the adjudication of the challenged ballots. 7 ballots have been challenged. On July 7, Ogletree Deakins filed an objection with the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, about conduct that may have affected the union election. The 4-page affidavit claims there were, quote, administrative failures in the mail ballot process. The university's attorneys also objected to the momentary departure of an NLRB agent conducting the court. Korn says Duke's real motive is, quote, to maintain power and have the only voice of what Duke University Press should look like. Duke is desperately trying to do anything to not to have to listen to the vote. Duke is desperately putting these legal barriers in the way. Ogletree Deakins is a formidable opponent. According to NLRB records, Ogletree has represented Duke University in dozens of labor cases since 2000. The company's website touts the firm as, quote, a pioneer in developing strategies and practices that create positive employee relations. Korn says Duke has a history of organizing against its employees' efforts to create unions for greater bargaining power. She points to Karen Brodkin-Sack's Caring by the Hour, Women, Work, and Organizing at Duke Medical Center, a 1988 book that chronicles the efforts of medical center workers to unionize during the 1970s and the university's stiff resistance to unionization. In 2016, Duke's graduate students formed a union with the Service Workers International Union. Duke University office officials responded by spending millions to fight the union effort, according to the Duke Graduate Student Union website. Korn says the creation of a workers' union at Duke Press is, quote, part of a wave of workers in the publishing and communications industry who want a greater say in what our workplace in the future looks like. She points to workers with Oxford University Press, the largest academic press in the country, who in late June announced they were forming a union. In early July, workers with the University of Washington Press, the largest academic press in the Pacific Northwest, also formed a union. The push by DUP employees to create a workers' union literally started with a bang, the deadly early morning downtown gas explosion on April 10th of 2019. It was the Bull City's 150th anniversary. The concussive blast shook the DUP offices. It also jarred the consciousness of the 75 to 80 DUP employees who streamed out of the building onto Main Street. They could see the smoke rising from the caffeinated coffee shop and soon saw the flames that killed Kong Lee and injured 25 others. Willoughby Harris, who said, "We were getting different messages from the managers about what had happened." Willoughby Harris explained the gas leak explosion jump-started a series of conversations about the varying levels of information they had about the explosion. That led to other concerns about transparency, paid family leave, and unfair salaries. Willoughby Harris, who's been with DUP for 35 years, says living in Durham right now on academic publishing wages is tough. We're looking for something that will allow us to keep our heads above water. Korn says DUP employees' efforts to unionize have been met with fierce opposition from management, saying the workers have received press releases encouraging them to vote against the union. DUP editor says the opposition has been spearheaded by Dean Smith, director of the academic press. Korn says, "I can only assess that it was something he was told to do by the anti-union lawyers. Right now there is intense pressure in our workplace. Despite the pressure, the majority of us are still holding on to form a union." Willoughby Harris is convinced that she and her fellow workers should have a voice in their workplace. "We deserve a place at the table and being part of the conversation." And the NLRB is expected to render a decision about the union as soon as this month. Carol Espinosa-Jane reports from Wake County in the Balance. For residents of Wellington Park, a mobile home community in Wake Forest, the next few months could mean the end of their homes and community. Residents organized a press conference late last month to oppose a proposed rezoning and redevelopment of Wellington Park. More than 230 people showed up to rally against the rezoning, calling for both George Mackey Jr., the park's owner and former Wake Forest mayor, and the Wake Forest Board of Commissioners to stop the rezoning and sale of the property. Mackey is said to be making plans to sell Wellington Park to Middleburg Communities, a real estate group that has acquired or built over 20,000 apartments and executed over $2.5 billion in transactions in the Southeast and Mid-Atlantic regions, according to its website. Wake Forest commissioners are set to vote on the rezoning later this summer. If the rezoning is approved, Middleburg Communities would be greenlit to redevelop the neighborhood, making it unaffordable for those currently living in the mobile home park, residents fear. And even if the rezoning is not approved, Mackey still has the ability to evict the residents, says Katia Roebuck, an organizer at One Wake, a multi-ethnic coalition of faith-based and civic organizations working on behalf of Wellington residents. The Indies' attempts to reach Mackey last week were unsuccessful. If the property is sold, residents say it could not only render dozens of North Carolinians homeless with possible job insecurity, but also eliminate one of the few remaining sources of affordable housing in Wake County. Carol Ornette, a Wellington Park resident, said that even with the affordable cost of living in the mobile home park, he can't afford to move out on a fixed income. He said, I live in about $1,000 Social Security, and you know what rent goes for if you're finding a new space. I couldn't possibly afford to get an apartment, move out, and have money to afford whatever place I live in. I'll be homeless, and I don't see any way of solving this problem. Ornette, a Vietnam War veteran, is not the only resident who spoke up about potentially facing homelessness if the property is successfully sold and rezoned. Erica and Eduardo Sevilla, two siblings and residents of Wellington Park, said having to move poses challenges for them as well. Erica Sevilla said at the press conference, as the oldest daughter and first-generation American, the burden of finding a new home would fall on me. I do not have the knowledge, experience, or have established enough credit to help find a new and better home for my family. Sophia Miro, another resident of Wellington, said that a possible solution would be for Mackie to sell the property to ROC USA, which is a nonprofit that assists mobile park residents in forming cooperatives to purchase their own parks. ROC stands for Resident-Owned Community. Miro said, we are gathering today not just to ask the commissioners to vote no, but also to ask the commissioners to meet with this organization in August to better understand the alternative solution. Roebuck, the One Wake organizer, said that residents and community groups, such as her organization and the NC Congress of Latino Organizations, are in constant contact with the Wake Forest Board of Commissioners and Wellington Park's owner to negotiate the future of the mobile home park. Roebuck said that selling the property to ROC would be the best compromise between residents and Mackie. She added that ROC USA has enough funds to likely rival the deal between Mackie and Middleburg communities. Roebuck said, we don't see Mr. Mackie as the enemy. We just wanted to think hard about where these people are going. Bridget Wall Lennon, a Wake Forest commissioner, was the only commissioner to make a public appearance at the press conference. While Wall Lennon said she could not disclose her stance on the rezoning ahead of time, she said she did want residents to know she and the other Wake Forest commissioners were listening to their demands. She said, I don't really want to say anything formally. I just wanted to let you all know that I was present. In the meantime, things are unclear for residents of Wellington Park. Roebuck said that with the final decision of the mobile parks rezoning not coming till late summer, residents are anxiously waiting to learn where they really will have to face homelessness. Roebuck told the Indy, what we want from the commissioners, obviously, is to vote no on this project, rezoning, and for Mr. Mackie to be open to selling his park to ROC. Meanwhile, stakeholders are working on contingency plans. Last Thursday, Roebuck and other organizers met with representatives of Middleburg communities who appeared open to providing residents with enough compensation to successfully relocate should the development move forward, Roebuck told Indy. Quote, they're losing a lot of money if the rezoning doesn't pass, so everybody has an interest here, the commissioners, the developers, and the park residents. We're just helping the park residents to not be homeless. Next, Lee Toss from Raleigh, called The Fourth Wave. The Delta variant is surging through North Carolina. 40% of residents remain unvaccinated. Those watching the numbers knew it was going to be a bad week. After months of keeping the spread of COVID mostly at bay through an aggressive vaccination campaign, restrictions eased this summer. Just as a new threat emerged, an even more contagious strain of the virus known as the Delta variant. New cases of the virus and hospitalizations, nearly all among the 40% of North Carolinians who remain unvaccinated, began to uptick at first, moving slowly from the low hundreds to just over 1,000 by mid-July. Then, just from Monday to Tuesday last week, the number of cases doubled to more than 3,000. By Friday, 10% of COVID-19 tests were coming back positive, the worst rate since February. Dr. Cameron Wolf, an infectious disease specialist at Duke Hospital, expects the number of cases to only increase more in the coming weeks. And he says, it's baked into the system that number is going to go up for at least a couple of weeks. All of those people who were exposed yesterday, for example, are not likely to get sick for a couple of days. With the Delta variant, the timeline is condensed a little bit. you're in fact more infectious more quickly with this. So we're seeing a hospitalization impact more quickly. What we can't know yet is how bad things could get or how quickly. While the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention updated its guidance last week to urge even the vaccinated to wear masks indoors to prevent the spread of the virus, Governor Cooper has yet to reinstate any restrictions locally. Cooper did announce Thursday that state employees would be required to receive the vaccine and urged other employers to follow suit. And some local governments, such as Wake County and the cities of Raleigh and Durham, have required masks in public buildings once again. But with no current mask mandate at the state level and all gathering restrictions lifted, counties throughout North Carolina have seen a surge in cases. Mayor Matt Shewell from Durham said he will meet this week with public health officials and scientists at Duke Health to discuss Durham's response to the variant. He wrote in a text message, "Just a month ago, we had less than 5 cases per day. Now we are up to 40. This is a very serious increase, and we have to respond accordingly." Mandy Cohen, North Carolina's Secretary of Health and Human Services, echoed the concerns more broadly, saying, "Our trends are accelerating at an alarmingly fast rate, and the highest rates of viral spread are happening in areas with low vaccination rates and among those who are not fully vaccinated." The state has administered almost 10 million doses of vaccine, and as of Friday, 57% of adults are fully vaccinated and 61% have received their first dose. The problem has been convincing the remaining population to get the shot. According to Wolf, oftentimes the state's anti-vaxxers don't change their minds until they end up on a hospital gurney. "It does change people's opinion. There's no question about that," said Wolf. "There's nothing fun about being hypoxic in a hospital. It's an awful situation to face." A series of million-dollar government-sponsored lottery drawings barely moved the needle. While vaccinations surged in April after becoming available to the general population, the rate began to bottom out in late May and has continued to decline. Fewer than 100,000 new doses are now being administered per week. As evidenced by the uptick in cases, the current vaccination rate isn't fast enough to curb the spread of the Delta variant, which is not only more contagious, but also has been shown to make people sicker, faster, and sometimes more severely, says Wolf. Part of the reason is that viruses mutate each time they are transmitted from person to person, says Duke Professor David Montefiore, who leads the Laboratory for AIDS Vaccine Research and Development. "This means the longer the pandemic rages on, the more new strains are likely to emerge." He says the more we can shut this pandemic down and slow down the spread of the virus, the less opportunity it's going to have to mutate and change and become more contagious. The mutation rate is dependent on the transmission rate, how many times the virus has transmitted from one person to another, and how long it's been continuing to replicate in the human population. That's what drives mutations and allows the accumulation of multiple mutations to occur. Although the Delta variant is evolving quickly, vaccines are still effective against it. Booster shots will likely be necessary for the future to strengthen immunity to new and emerging variants. If vaccination rates don't increase, the Triangle especially could be in for a surge next month when students from Duke, UNC Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State return from summer vacation. Last year, in-person classes were abruptly canceled and moved online after outbreaks were reported within days of students' return to campus. While Duke is requiring all staff, students, and faculty members to be vaccinated, the UNC systems will not, instead relying on once-a-week testing and students self-reporting their vaccination status. The end game is simple: either increase the rate of vaccination or wait for herd immunity, which won't occur without significant fatalities. For Cohen, the latter's not an option. She says there's only one way out of this pandemic, and that is vaccination. "If you are already vaccinated, I call upon you to urge your unvaccinated family and friends to get their shot now. It's not an understatement to say that you will save lives by doing so." All right, education. Greg Childress now reports, "Education last." If culturally responsive teaching is allowed in North Carolina's public schools, students will learn that math is racist. Students who are black, LGBTQ, or of minority ethnic backgrounds will be taught that teachers are bigots. And educators will be allowed to engage in age-inappropriate promotion of homosexuality. That's what some alarmists wrote in email messages to State Superintendent of Public Instruction Catherine Truitt earlier this year as part of a concerted effort by conservatives to influence public school curricula and combat critical race theory. Critical race theory is an academic discipline that examines how racism has shaped American law and public policy. It's also the Republican Party's wedge issue du jour. House Bill 324, for example, is a bill supported by Truitt and inspired by the anti-CRT movement that seeks to limit what can be taught in North Carolina's public schools about America's racial past. The measure has been approved by the House and the support of Senate leader Phil Berger, a Republican from Rockingham County. Berger has vowed to keep critical race theory out of schools, though most educators say it is not part of K-12 curricula in North Carolina. Policy Watch obtained Truitt's messages as part of public records request, which sought the emails the superintendent received containing the phrase critical race theory between January 1 and June 1. The Department of Public Instruction turned over 157 messages in which writers mentioned the subject. Truitt's emails show just how effective state Republicans and other actors, such as Education First Alliance, a conservative nonprofit that crusades against critical race theory, have been at whipping the party's base into a frenzy over a once obscure academic subject. One message said, "Curriculum based on critical race theory is inherently racist and discriminatory, with its focus on race alone as the only way to categorize and analyze people and their behavior." The emails also show the enormous pressure Truitt faced before canceling a contract with ISKME, the Institute for the Study of Knowledge Management in Education. The Department of Public Instruction had hired the independent education nonprofit to train educators in culturally responsive teaching. The teaching practice recognizes the importance of including students' cultural references in all forms of learning. Sloan Rachmuth, president of Education First Alliance, has chided Truitt about supporting the group's training, contending it contradicts the GOP's policy position against critical race theory. Rachmuth and other critics contend that culturally responsive teaching is rooted in critical race theory. Messages between Rachmuth and Truitt on a Sunday afternoon in late March show that even after the superintendent shared that DPI had dropped the program, Rachmuth demanded that Truitt make the news public. He wrote, "I'm not sure you grasp the interest that the North Carolina public has in stopping the spread of CRT in schools. Besides election integrity, it's the number one issue GOP voters care about, and it's an issue that unites the right and left. If you do actually hate critical race theory, then why are you hiding the fact you've canceled this Common Core style critical race theory training? You are raising more questions than you are answering." Rachmuth's message was sent after Truitt explained how the cancellation came about. She said, "This was an internal decision. We do not make announcements for something as basic as removing an inappropriate training. I know many of your followers know it was removed because I got email to this effect." The messages warning Truitt about the dangers of culturally responsive teaching mentioned North Carolina educator Christina Spears and education consultant Jamila Coase. The two co-led online training in the discipline as part of the contract between DPI and ISKME. Spears, a special assistant in the Wake County Public School System Office of Equity Affairs, said DPI dropped the contract soon after the Trump-Truitt administration took office. Spears agreed to discuss the contract in her role as a consultant with ISKME, saying, "In January, we got some pushback about culturally relevant teaching, and folks from DPI wanted to be in on the webinars and to see everything beforehand. Unfortunately, we weren't able to finish that contract." Rachmuth urged the superintendent to ensure that Spears was fired. Quote, I meant what I said. We are not dropping this issue with Department of Public Instruction. We want transparency, and we want those complicit in spreading CRT in schools fired. And that includes Pam Batchelor, a digital learning systems consultant with DPI, Christina Spears, and others. In a March 21st message, Rockmuth urged Truitt to, quote, come clean about this teacher training and confirm this dangerous program has been stopped. Parents are not going away, and we want answers. The message got Truitt's attention. The superintendent moved quickly to arrange an in-person meeting with Rockmuth. 2 days later, Marge Santoro, the superintendent's executive assistant, contacted Rockmuth to schedule a meeting. Santoro offered 3 possible meeting dates in late March. Subsequent messages show that a scheduled meeting was canceled. Truitt and Rockmuth attempted to reschedule, but it's unclear whether the two ultimately met. The messages about the unfounded fear of culturally responsive teaching appear to be a form letter signed and emailed to Truitt on March 20. But dozens of people who also shared concerns about critical race theory. Other messages in early February, just ahead of the State Board of Education vote on new social studies standards, urged Truitt to vote against the standards, which writers argued are based on critical race theory. The emails Truitt received might explain why the superintendent fought vigorously to have the phrases systemic racism, systemic discrimination, and gender identity removed from the standards. The phrases were replaced with racism, discrimination, and identity to make them more inclusive, Truitt said. Although critical race theory was not widely discussed, at least publicly, by state education leaders in February, messages sent to Truitt and the state board show that the topic weighed heavily on the minds of those opposed to the new state social studies standards. Before the Board of Education met in February to vote on the social studies standards, a critic of critical race theory named Kyle Wyckoff sent a typical comment, quote, I am a concerned citizen who is very disturbed about the thought that you are considering passing education legislation promoting critical race theory in our North Carolina public schools. Critical race theory divides students and makes them victims. We need leaders who will stand up against these theories that have long-lasting repercussions in the years to come, that if promoted and passed, will further divide our country instead of bringing unity based on shared values. Another writer claimed to stand with Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson in opposition to the new standards. Robinson, a Republican from Greensboro and the state's first black lieutenant governor, voted against the new standards after declaring there is no systemic racism in America. The writer said any curriculum based on critical race theory is inherently racist and discriminatory. Quote, curriculum must strive to truthfully explain our history, reflecting the unparalleled success of the United States when compared to any other country in the world, now or in the past. The board approved the standards in a contentious vote, in which conservatives opposed the standards and progressives supported them. After the new standards were adopted, Robinson created a task force. He dubbed Fairness and Accountability in the Classroom for Teachers and Students. Its purpose, he said, is to give students, teachers, and parents a, quote, voice to speak out about cases of bias, inappropriate material, or indoctrination they see or experience in public schools. Robinson has received more than 500 messages as part of the effort, many from people attempting to provide examples of teachers indoctrinating students with cultural and political biases. The lieutenant governor is expected to soon share his findings. But news organizations and private citizens have already obtained and examined them after filing public records requests. One unidentified writer complained about a teacher in Orange County who wore a Black Lives Matter shirt on her Bitmoji while providing remote learning. The writer also complained that a female teacher often talked about her wife at home. This writer said, I pulled my children to homeschool this year after getting nowhere with the principal and then hearing through the grapevine he talked with district and they hired a lawyer and then immediately approved that Black Lives Matter could be worn by teachers. Several other commenters, however, took Robinson to task for launching an initiative that they derided as partisan. One wrote, "You represent all of North Carolina, not just the red voters." All right, the cover story at the Indy Week is about tipping at food restaurants. Several prominent Triangle restaurants are shifting away from tipping. Lena Geller wrote this. "I work at a restaurant with counter service. This means that within a few minutes of a customer's walking through that doorway, I must ask whether or not they want to leave me a tip. Well, technically I have to take their order and turn over the iPad, and the iPad asks them for tips. During this part of the transaction, I usually look at the floor. At least once a day, after I flip the tip screen, some guy asks me why he should tip when he's barely experienced any service. Sometimes he's genuinely confused or annoyed. Sometimes the question is relayed with a wink. If I could, I'd tell him that tipping isn't actually in place to reward good service. It's an entrenched cultural custom that allows employers to cut down on labor costs and forces servers like me to justify our value to customers who may not understand the system. During the height of the pandemic, this dynamic became especially uncomfortable when I needed to ask unmasked customers to cover up before they'd chosen whether or not to tip. But as frustrating as these encounters are, at the end of the day, customers aren't the root of the problem. The root, of course, is the institution. Over the past year, the pandemic heightened public awareness of working conditions in the service industry. As structural fragilities of the traditional model came to light, the discourse around tipping grew more critical, and some Triangle restaurant owners saw an opportunity to start chipping away at the industry's cast iron conventions. Aaron Vandermark, chef owner of Pansuto in Hillsborough, says he's wanted to eliminate tipping for years. The pandemic gave him time to devise an alternative. He says tipping creates this arbitrary wage with unwritten rules that are different from one restaurant and one culture to the next, and it's unequal pay for equal work, which is potentially a constitutional issue. And after COVID restrictions forced Durham's COPA to shut down indoor dining and shift to takeout-only model, co-owner Elizabeth Turnbull realized she could no longer rely on voluntary gratuities to fund a living wage for her employees. She says, "People are notoriously low tippers on takeout, and we knew without these tips we couldn't keep our team members employed. But we were also taking a hit on income, so to keep our kitchen staff at a living wage as well, we needed to be able to use some of that for them." In April of 2020, Turnbull abandoned traditional tipping and in its place implemented an automatic 20% gratuity, also known as a fair wage charge. Beyond ensuring a living wage, Turnbull says, she saw the charge as a way to eliminate the skewed power dynamic that tipping creates between workers and patrons, and as a way to channel more money to back-of-the-house employees. Unlike tips, which tend to belong exclusively to servers, automatic gratuities belong to the employer and can therefore be distributed amongst both front- and back-of-house employees. Vandermark instituted a 4% service charge at Pansuto shortly before the pandemic started, funneling the charge's revenue to kitchen staff in efforts to distribute tip money more equitably among employees. Mid-COVID, he increased that charge to 18% and dispensed with tipping. About a month ago, Andrea Reusing, chef owner at Lantern in Chapel Hill, followed suit, as did Gray Brooks, Cara Stacey, and Jay Owens, who own Pizzeria Toro in Durham. In Orange and Durham counties, employers that pay workers a livable wage, that is, a wage that meets or exceeds the county's established amount of income needed for an individual to meet their basic needs without government assistance, employers can become living wage certified. Though there has been confusion over whether or not a restaurant can get certified if they're achieving the living wage through tips or service fees, Carl Rist, a co-founder and board member of the Durham Living Wage Project, confirmed with Indy that it is possible and that it's this provision which allowed COPA, Pansuto, and Lantern to become certified years ago. But since implementing the fair wage charge, These three residents no longer have to rely on said sanction to remain certified because they're using revenue from the charge to fund a fixed living wage of at least $15 in Durham and $15.40 in Orange County for all hourly workers. This means that employees' earnings no longer reflect week-to-week fluctuations in business, which can be a risky commitment for owners to make. If they set the charge percentage too low and the hourly rate too high, they won't be able to follow through on the wages they've promised, and they'll have to shut down. Reusing says, "It's a big step, and I think this is why it's hard for restaurants to get their mind around it, because you're committing to a wage that you're paying. If we miscalculate, it could be very bad." In the United States, tipping is a relic of the post-Reconstruction era. The practice has been around for centuries, and is generally thought to have been imported from European aristocratic conventions. By the 1930s, it had become standardized in the United States as a way for employers in the hospitality industry to avoid fully compensating workers, many of them former enslaved people and people of color, for their work, relying instead on voluntary gratuities from customers. The tip model gained traction as business owners jumped on the opportunity to cut labor costs, and when the tip credit was introduced in 1966, a provision under the Fair Labor Standards Act allowing employers to pay tipped workers half the minimum wage so long as tips made up the other half, the practice became firmly ingrained in the American restaurant model. In 1996, the FLSA was modified so the minimum wage for tipped workers would no longer increase alongside the federal minimum wage. While most European restaurants have shifted to a tipless model that builds labor costs into the menu or tacks a small mandatory service charge into the bill, in the United States, the tipping wage floor has been stuck at $2.13 for more than a decade, and it doesn't seem to be rising anytime soon. This, for many restaurant owners, is what makes the tip credit too lucrative not to take. Although modern tipping isn't as overtly discriminatory as it was in the 30s, it quietly perpetuates the culture that birthed it. Mounds of research demonstrate that people with lighter skin who are able-bodied and conventionally attractive are tipped more generously. While biting my tongue around unmasked customers was unpleasant, it was something I controlled. For servers who aren't young and white, there may be a little to nothing they can do to ensure a tip, given some customers' implicit biases. And while pooling tips can help correct for this sort of discrimination, that practice doesn't change the sexualized culture that encourages servers, more than 60% of who are women, to objectify themselves. Tip pooling also doesn't resolve the larger pay disparity that tipping creates between front and back of the house workers. Historically, the FLSA has prohibited kitchen staff from participating in tip pools. This is a worker protection under the tip credit law to ensure that servers make enough tips to achieve the minimum wage. Back of the house isn't allowed a piece of the pie. But because tips can enable servers to make more than the minimum wage, the law has resulted in front-of-house workers, who are usually white, consistently earning more than kitchen staff, who are more often people of color. A 2018 amendment to FLSA now allows restaurants that don't take the tip credit to include the back-of-house employees in tip pools, but this practice was prohibited for so long that many owners aren't interested in reworking their models to accommodate it. For restaurateurs hoping to pay employees more equitably, pooling tips across all hourly employees can be a good start. At the restaurant where I work, tips are split evenly amongst servers and kitchen staff, which levels the playing field. But for those hoping to move away from tipping altogether, the amendment is a band-aid on a bullet hole. Customer backlash has not made changes any easier. While there was a movement during COVID to support restaurant workers, once lockdowns eased and restaurants were challenged in attracting workers back, public sentiment seemed to shift. When Pizzeria Toro announced, for instance, they had implemented a fair wage charge, dozens of people pushed back on Facebook, writing they would take their business elsewhere. Commenter David Brown wrote, we won't be supporting you. I leave a gratuity based on the service, not politics. 20% living wage fee? Ha ha, eat it yourself. You chose to be a server, so earn your tip. Don't force customers to tip when something the server deserved nothing. At Lantern, Andrea Reusing says it's too soon to know if she's landed on the right numbers, but she's open to tweaking the model as needed. Vandermark agrees that only time will tell. The question that we'll all have to figure out, she says, is you get 12 months in and $1,000 extra came in above wages you distributed. What is that $1,000? Excess revenue could be potentially saved to pad paychecks during slower months, Vandermark says, but if he's consistently making more money than he's paying people, he'll increase wages. At Pizzeria Toro, the fair wage charge works a little bit differently. Revenue from the charge is put into its own pot and distributed on a weekly basis, like a traditional tip pool. Both front and back of house workers receive a cut, which varies depending on position. Kitchen staff are paid a higher base rate, but get a smaller cut of the charge, and the front of the house receives a lower rate and a larger cut. While Toro's wages are being distributed more equitably, they're still bound to fluctuate because the owners aren't using the charge to fund a guaranteed living wage. This could suggest that Toro hasn't been quite as steadfast in his shift away from tipping, but Brooks says the unfixed rate leaves room to grow. And he says, as we continue to get busier, that 20% that goes entirely to staff will grow as well. If we simply raised our prices and gave everyone raises, they wouldn't see their pay increase as our business increased. Jason Calixto, a part-time bartender and manager at Toro, says he and his co-workers generally approve of the new model, though it does seem a bit murky. Adding, it constantly feels as if the owners are having to pay less out of pocket and getting to rely more on the fee they're charging. Calixto's sentiment echoes a question many people seem to be asking. Why not just eliminate service charges, increase menu prices, and pay your staff a living wage? Brooks says this feels like a bizarro world argument. He says, I don't have the greatest business acumen in the world, but I know the basics are you have a revenue stream and you pay your costs with that. So this weird idea of why should customers have to pay for your wages is, well, customers pay for everything. But when I ask Brooks if he fears raising menu prices would scare people away, he says yes. Turnbull, Reusing, and Vandermark all say the same thing. Even though customers would ultimately be paying the same total cost with higher menu prices as they would with lower prices plus tip, it's too hard for them to stomach the price without the smoke and mirrors of the service fee. Reusing said, it's kind of like three-card Monty. It's all about what you're calling it. By basing its model on worker exploitation, the industry has left customers with such a warped perception of labor costs that restaurants looking to topple the system are quickly outpriced by competitors, losing too much business to stay afloat. It's capitalism at its finest. At least one Durham restaurant has weathered the shift to a model without service charges. In May, Monette's Donuts raised its menu prices by 18%, eliminated all service fees, and committed to paying employees a fixed living wage. So far, it's working. For more expensive restaurants like Copa and Panciuto, though, where increased menu costs might be more off-putting to customers, owners see the fair wage charge as a rational first step toward reshaping industry standards. Turnbull, we have not been taught by our culture to understand the price breakdown and think about the labor. If you see a $20 sandwich on the menu, you're going to be like, what is going on? But when you see it as a living wage fee, it puts it in perspective. And I have found that our guests are tremendously generous about it. As Aaron Vandermark sees it, there is no turning back. The origins are disgusting, and the modernization of tipping today still has all these problems. For me, it was either you're going to be a part of this system or you're going to blow it up. All right, I'll move to some music now. Brian Howe article, Follow the Sun. The hip-hop strut and far-out sounds of Don't Save Me for Later might startle fans who think of Metallica strictly as a pop R&B artist, but her collaboration with Jerome Scorsese was written in the stars. By the way, her name is performers as M, the numeral 8, and A-L-L-A, Maytala, and that's my best shot at pronouncing it. Singer and songwriter Mbala Menduga says, "I've never met anyone, no, I've never met a man who's into astrology like I am," she laughs on the Zoom call from her new apartment in Los Angeles. "He was going into my chart in the first session, and I was like, I know what you're saying. I'm just amazed that you know what you're saying." Jerome Scorsese, a Raleigh-based producer in the big-eared tradition of the Neptunes and Timbaland, furnished beats for the Durham rapper Kelly Kale's breakout album Give 'Em Hell last summer. Menduga, who knew Jerome socially, was especially stunned by Hot If You Nasty, which begins with a stereo pan swirl of synths and a sinister laugh. Menduga says, "Jerome does this thing I love, where you hear the first sound and it's like, whoa, where is this going? What am I listening to, and why do I kind of like it?" Menduga moved to Chapel Hill in 2009 after being born in Paris and growing up in Washington, D.C., the child of Cameroonian diplomats. "People see and hear me and think, she's R&B, she's African. But he gets a side of me that I don't know a lot of people have brought out." That summer, Menduga and Kale started working on a song together, and Jerome sent Kale a beat he said Menduga could have. When she received it, she was with Shermar Davis, the Triad area singer-songwriter that had a single, So Far Gone, on the chic Parisian electronic label Maison Kitsune last year, who was helping her work on the follow-up, produced by Alec Lomani, of her 2017 album, Never Leave Quietly. Menduga says, "Alec is a very calm guy who lets you do. He's incredibly patient. He's given me all the beats to write on, but I just didn't believe in myself anymore." Davis became Menduga's musical lifeline when she was struggling with writer's block and self-doubt, afflictions that parted long enough to reveal a ray of sunshine that was last summer's Make Me Anxious. But that was a collaboration with Durham's Tree City, separate from the album, and she'd written that song years before. Menduga says, "I owe Shermar the world because I was so discouraged after Make Me Anxious, from both the state of the world and the fact we couldn't go out and support one of my best songs." Davis had often reached out to ask if she needed help with her music, and finally, she said yes. They started getting together in her home studio every couple of weeks, and with his encouragement, the music started to flow. When she got that first beat from Jerome, Davis urged her to get on it right away. She added a verse she had written but never used and sent it back. When she got together with Jerome, she wrote the song We Hear on the spot. She says, "I wrote a song in 45 minutes, and it felt really good." That song is Gimme Racks, a raunchy future trap workout that opens with a weird mooing bass line. Menduga was a fan of the Durham rapper Duce Drop Top's song Zaza, so she got him on the track and shaped her flow to his. He has this nice rasp, a low whispery tone to his voice, she says. So I was like, yeah, I'm just going to float on this. I'm not going to do the most. The three-song EP, a distinct project from the album it helped revitalize, was mastered with the clarity its Baroque style demands by the Greensboro-based engineer LaFell Taylor. On the Ego Check, What Happened, another woozy bass mingles with Asian strings, while lead single and video Lady with a Choppa is laid back but tightly wound duet with Kale. In a way, it's the flip side of Make Me Anxious. Instead of being about anxiety over how our relationship was playing out, it's like, okay, this person is playing, Menduga says. That no-bullshit energy was cultivated by Jerome. Menduga vividly remembers his first reaction to the track she'd been working on. He was like, "I can see that you're in your Cancer moon," because I was talking about love. "That's cool, but I want to balance you out. I want you to come into your sun sign, your Aries vibe." I was like, okay, I remember her. I very much believe in the power of the tongue. I was singing a lot of heartbreak songs, and that's not who I want to be. I wanted something boastful, where I could assert myself, but also speak prosperity into my future. The partial move to L.A., Menduga still rents an apartment in Durham, was part of that vision. She'd been traveling there periodically to work on music and make connections, finding a network of fellow North Carolina expats. In June, the move unfolded as if ordained by fate. She says, all the places I found on websites were too expensive, but I walked into a nice building in my budget in Koreatown, run by a woman from the South, so I'm getting Southern hospitality in a family-owned apartment complex in L.A. Germ moved to the city around the same time. With this fresh start on fertile ground, the second Amidala album may be with us sooner than later. But as for whether it portends a bright future as a record artist or a songwriter, a collaborator, and who knows what else, well, Manduka has gained enough momentum as an artist to know the cost and the self-trust to let the stars say if it's worth it. She says, I cater my time to authentic individual relationships, so the demand for content creation and access to me as a person, if I'm being honest, can be very taxing. She says, spoken like a true cancer. But now, I'm writing songs not just for me, but submitting them to bigger artists here, because ultimately what I love is the writing and the studio. I want this project to do whatever it's supposed to do. If that means catapulting me into the songwriter space, I want that, because I love that. If that means catapulting me into the artist space, I'll take that, because I am that. So the album is called Don't Save Me for Later. I believe I have time for reviews of two local albums by Permanent and 6WXO. They seek out the weird meditative corners of electronic music. The first review by Will Atkinson is Permanent and the album Social Disease. In the 1980s, a generation of underground artists married the do-it-yourself ethos of punk with the then-novel tools of electronic dance music, releasing records that had brought to life a darker, harsher version of synth pop, almost playful in its deadpan austerity. Some of those groups, like Germany's DAF, went on to have surprisingly successful careers on major labels. Most, though, languished in obscurity, their releases surviving decades through vinyl and cassette enthusiasts and eventually the endless archive of the Internet. It's fitting that recording under the name Permanent, Durham's Mimi Luce, L-U-S-E, would make a home here. For the last couple of years, Luce has made a habit of seeking out the weirder corners of pop music, from the ye-ye-inspired post-punk of 2019's Cochon to the sound collages of last year's Manhole Project. Permanent Social Disease, released June 25th by Brooklyn-based cassette label Modern Tapes, is Luce's latest stylistic turn. Almost entirely self-produced on vintage samplers and synthesizers, except for one collaboration with Durham's Young Target, Social Disease is a celebration of those early experiments in industrial and techno. The record is open about its influences. Luce cites DAF, the Australian group Spuck, and throbbing gristle spin-off Chris and Cozy as some of her main touch points. But alternately, this deconstruction builds upon the basic formula of mechanized bass lines and distorted drum machines. Opener Psychotic Crush, for instance, sounds like an engine haltingly sputtering to life, teasing a four-on-the-floor pulse that never arrives. From there, the album moves deftly between body and atmosphere. Even the most dance-floor-ready highlights, like Big White Hearse and Digital Bride, are coated with ambient dissonance around the edges, recalling the found sound techniques of Luce's work as Manhole. Whether this direction is as enduring as the project's name suggests, or if Luce's previous projects are any indication, Permanent is just a temporary detour, remains to be seen. But for now, it's an invigorating study into a pivotal moment in the underground. That review of 3.5 stars by Will Atkinson. And the other one is 6WX0, which is self-titled and self-released. It's given a 4-star review by Harris Wheelis. This self-styled cassette is Will Brooks' second project as 6WX0, a moniker he adopted just before moving home to his native North Carolina. After jaunts up and down both coasts, Brooks initially made a mark in the L.A. rave scene, releasing Left Field House as Eli Cash before switching gears with two digital compilations, Volume 1 and Volume 2, which served as his 6 Weeks Old debut. On this new release, he makes a turn away from beat-oriented music toward immersive, synth-heavy ambient pieces. Following the lead of Japanese ambient music pioneer Hiroshi Yoshimura's Green, Brooks merges artistic process with natural creation, constructing a symbiotic audio ecosystem between his natural surroundings via field recordings and the listener's headspace. This is achieved on tracks like Waving by the distant rustle of animals, running water, and slow-moving ambient washes as warm synth leads and bass drift into the foreground. As on Duke Ellington's Queen's Suite, where instruments court comparison with natural elements, sounds can be imagined. Songs can be imagined as natural song, skittering bass for the croak of a bullfrog, or ambient padding as a soft blanket of crickets. On other tracks, the Immunity Loop and Driftwood, electronica fills the landscape with descending synth chords, a la Terry Riley's Dervishes, and a bright marimba tone pulses, later reverberating synth and ambient swirls. As in binaural recording, which is sound recorded with two microphones in order to map a 3D oral experience, New Age music often renders the sonic experience of a space in your head. It's not simply a physical space, but rather a state of meditation, hyperconsciousness of one's surroundings, and mediation of inner noise in pursuit of relaxation or deep thought. And the last track on this review, Night Sweats, reaches a kind of epiphany in sound. Stretches of dense, distorted synth leads, almost approaching white noise, gradually fade into the sound of twittering birds and heavy footsteps which seem to come towards you up a mossy garden path. Harris Wheeler's review of 6 Weeks Old is 4 stars. And the length of this broadcast has to cut out several articles and some lengthy articles as well. And we're approaching the end of our broadcast of Indie Week, and John Federson reminding you that ncbeatingservice.org carries this and earlier broadcasts of Indie Week, stretching way back to the dawn of time, on our website, ncreadingservice.org. And until we're with you next time, have a good week, and Indie Week signing off for now. So long.